As Crew Dragon triumphs, we enjoy Planetary Adventures with Lou Friedman, this week on Planetary Radio.
Splashdown.
As you can see on your screen, we have visual confirmation for Splashdown.
SpaceX copies and concurs. We see Splashdown and mains cut.
Dragon Endeavour has returned home. NASA astronauts Bob and Doug.
On behalf of the SpaceX and NASA teams, welcome back to planet Earth, and thanks for flying SpaceX.
The splashdown of Crew Dragon Endeavour, marking the end of Demo Mission 2 and the return of astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley from the International Space Station. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. I was one of the millions who watched, worried, and celebrated on Sunday, August 2nd. So was Garrett Reisman. The astronaut and former SpaceX Director of Space Operations is back with an inside view of this success. Then I've got another treat for you. The founding executive director of the Planetary Society, Louis Friedman, has collected some of his best stories in a new book, Planetary Adventures, and he'll share several with us. All that and Bruce Betts? But wait, there's more. Specifically, a look at the most recent edition of The Downlink, the great weekly newsletter from the Planetary Society. Headlines in a moment, but The Downlink also offers facts worth sharing, like this one. The total cost of NASA's Perseverance Mars rover mission, now on its way to the Red Planet, is what Americans spend on their pets every 10 days. And Perseverance is doing just fine after a couple of minor hiccups as it races along, accompanied by the UAE's Hope and China's Tianwen-1. Japan's Hayabusa 2 won't be done when it drops off samples from asteroid Ryugu in December. The JAXA space agency will redirect the probe to one of two asteroids. And here's some kind of record. The latest of Russia's Progress cargo delivery ships reached the ISS just over 3 hours after its launch. Top that, Amazon. All this and more comes your way every Friday at planetary.org/downlink. Did you catch Garrett Reisman when we talked with him in May, a few days before the launch of Demo Mission 2? Garrett lived on the International Space Station for 4 months in 2008, and then returned to space on Space Shuttle Atlantis in 2010, making two spacewalks. He's now a professor of astronautical engineering at the University of Southern California, but during 9 years at SpaceX, he rose quickly to Director of Space Operations with responsibility for all Dragon spacecraft, whether they were carrying cargo or preparing to carry men and women. The job included development of Mission Control Center operations, staffing, training, human control interfaces in the capsule, and life support. So do you think he would have missed Sunday's splashdown? Less than 24 hours later, Garrett rejoined me for this brief, celebratory, and very illuminating conversation. You'll hear him mention Super Dracos. Those are the small but powerful rocket engines that are integrated with the Dragon capsule and were used to decelerate it from orbit. Garrett, welcome back and congratulations.
Thanks, Matt. I'm still smiling from yesterday. So
I bet. And you have every right. Where were you when this new endeavor returned to Earth on Sunday?
I was up at our place up in the Pacific Northwest, and we had the family up here for summer vacation, and I was doing the broadcast for Discovery Channel and Science Channel. Oh. And so I was watching it live on a big monitor that they sent me and providing commentary along with Leland Melvin, Mike Massimino, and a couple other experts. So it was great to watch, but it was also, I had a job to do. And I, in a way, I kind of welcomed that because it was a welcome distraction. Otherwise, I think I would have been a total nervous wreck and not just mostly a nervous wreck.
Three of our favorite astronauts, but you're the one of those three who had the closest ties to this. I hate asking this question, but I don't see any way around it this time. How did it feel, first of all, to see the mission completed so successfully? And was it white knuckle time as you saw that capsule returning to Earth?
When, you know, one by one, there is a sequence of events, and each one of them were things that caused for concern or trepidation on my behalf. So the first was separation of the trunk. That's a very critical thing. When I was up on the space station, my commander, Peggy Whitson, and Yuri Malenchenko and Soyeon Lee came back, and they had a failed separation event. The Soyuz does something very similar, and theirs failed. And that was a very hazardous thing. They were lucky that it had a happy ending. So I was nervous about that. And then of course, you have the deorbit burn, and then you have to close a nose cone, and then you have to go through entry and the aerothermal regime, you know, the heating, and also the aerodynamic forces on a craft. This is the first time we brought humans back in a capsule that wasn't axisymmetric. And what I mean by that is, if you spin it about one axis like a top, all other capsules, think about an Apollo capsule, Mercury, Gemini, if you spun it, as it goes round and round, it would look exactly the same. But yeah. Dragon doesn't do that. It's not axisymmetric. It has those bump outs for the pods, for the Super Dracos.
Uh-huh.
That complicates things. It complicates the flow field around it, and it makes it harder to predict exactly what's going to happen. So we did tons of homework, and, you know, we tried it on demo one, but still, that was a cause for some white knuckle moments. And once that all went well, then you got to get the parachutes out, right? You got to go through those 6 minutes where you're in the dark, and then the parachutes got to come out, and you got to get the drogues and the mains. And then you still have to splash down and make sure that the thing doesn't get damaged when it hits the water at 15 miles an hour. And then you got to get it on the boat. And so, you know, one by one, everything went as good as it possibly could have gone. And so I started feeling better and better and better. And then by the time they got Bob and Doug out of the hatch, then I was pretty elated. But yeah, it was a roller coaster ride for me too.
It's the level of elation that I felt as well. And I'm not nearly as closely allied to what just took place as you are. But I think there are probably millions of us across the country who were feeling that tension and that relief and that thrill.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us were kind of thinking about, you know, the scene in Apollo 13 when they're trying to, they're all anxiously waiting for the blackout period to end. And then you see the parachutes, they cut to the parachutes coming out, right? And it was just like that, except the music was missing. We needed to score it better. if we had some really dramatic music when those parachutes, it would have been even better, but I'll take it. I'm looking forward to seeing the debriefs once there's a chance to really fully analyze the mission, and Bob and Doug have a chance to give their debrief and see what their top recommendations are. So we will definitely learn a lot from this test flight, not only from the comments of the crew, but also just from the wealth of data that we got back from the vehicle itself. The biggest lesson is that this public-private partnership model works. I think that any doubt, once Bob and Doug stepped out onto the deck of that ship, any doubt remaining as to whether or not this model is appropriate, I think is finally gone. And that's a big thing because like 10 years ago, that was far from a foregone conclusion.
Oh, yeah.
And there are many, many, many people who thought that frankly, this was a mistake.
When I tweeted out my congratulations yesterday, I included in that Lori Garver, former deputy administrator of NASA, and all the other folks at NASA who took a lot of flack beginning 10 years ago because they believed in this program and have a right to be as proud of it, maybe almost as proud as you and the folks at SpaceX, I would think.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, those early proponents, I would say, you know, got people like Lori, absolutely. Phil McAllister, who's been, you know, at this tenaciously from the beginning. Alan Lindemeyer, who really, because if it weren't for the success of the cargo program that he ran, none of this would have happened. The cargo program was the demo flight, if you will, for the crew program. And if we didn't have good success during the cargo program, it would have been way too easy for the naysayers to shut down this whole approach. And Bill Gerstenmaier, who when he was in charge, you know, stuck with it when there were plenty of people saying that we shouldn't. So there were a bunch of heroes at NASA. Like you said, they should get just as much recognition for this success as Elon and Gwynn and all the people at SpaceX who rightfully deserve, you know, a lot of credit too. But let's not forget the people who swam against the stream and made this happen.
I am so glad that you've mentioned all of that and those individuals and the rest of the folks that we haven't actually named.
Exactly. And by the way, I got to point out, whenever I start naming names, I'm going to forget somebody deserving.
Well, you know, it's like when you accept your Academy Award, right?
Right, right. And I'm just talking off the top of my head. So if I forgot somebody really important, I apologize.
So it's gone from that early challenging period to now when I heard so many people over the weekend, including NASA Administrator Bridenstine, who, of course, has been very supportive of this as well, who have called this the dawn of a new era in human spaceflight. Do you agree?
Absolutely. For a number of reasons. I've already talked about the importance of this model and what it can mean for NASA going forward to continue to use this model as we looked for Artemis, going to the moon. And with the human landing system, that big part of Artemis is being done as a public-private partnership. So that's already underway. I think potentially, this model would work really well for the Department of Defense could be a huge beneficiary of taking the same kind of approach as opposed to traditional cost plus contracts where you get, your $1 billion toilet seats that we all remember from the past. But it's more than that. It's much more than that, because part of this new model means that spacecraft, the Dragon, the Falcon 9 rocket that launched it, the boat that went out, the whole recovery team, the boat and all the people in the fast boats and the helicopters, none of those assets are owned by NASA. And that's remarkable. And they're not operated by NASA. You know, the control room was in Hawthorne. Those were all SpaceX employees. The people on the boat that did all the work were SpaceX. There were NASA people observing and assisting. But that capability now end to end exists. So what that means is SpaceX can now go make another Dragon, another Falcon 9, or even reuse this one and go fly people into space who are not NASA astronauts. And that's why this is really potentially the beginning of a whole new age, because now we're talking about real extension of space travel to the general population. Now, when I say general population, what I really mean are rich people. Okay, yeah. let me be clear about that. Your average Joe is not going to be able to pay for a ticket on Dragon. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars to buy a ticket. But there are suborbital opportunities coming right down the pike from Blue Origin and from Virgin Galactic, even sooner, I think. Now we're talking a couple hundred thousand. So now it's getting a little bit more reasonable. In my mind, it's kind of like what happened in the aviation industry and in the airline industry. In the very beginning, those first airlines were like Ford tri-motors, right? So they were like corrugated, tin-sided, held together with baling wire and chewing gum. But the only people who were able to afford to fly on the airlines were millionaires and movie stars, right? They would dress up in black tie to get on those things, to fly like from Burbank to Las Vegas or something, right? And now today we have Southwest and JetBlue, and now everybody, at least when there's not a pandemic going on, could just buy a ticket and go. So I think we're on that same trajectory in space, and it's just it's a question of time. So yes, when I say tourism is starting for the general public, it's not really the general public, it's rich people, but the price will come down, and we'll get better at this, and it'll become more economical. And I do believe that this is the beginnings of opportunities for everybody one day who wants to go to space to just buy a ticket and go. And I think that'd be great.
I'm saving my pennies. In the meantime, Garrett, it's great to get inspiration from successful missions like the one we just witnessed. Thank you for returning. Thank you for all your contributions to making this possible. And again, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Seeing... I think it was Theo that came and ran up to Bob on the stairs of the jet as he was landing in Houston and give him unscripted and uncontrolled running and with joy and just hugging his father's legs as he was wobbly coming down the stairs after being up in space for 2 months. Seeing that is congratulations enough. I don't need anything more. That was priceless.
Astronaut, professor of astronautical engineering, and former SpaceX director of space operations, Garrett Reisman. I'll be right back for some great storytelling by my old boss, Lou Friedman. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related. We invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks!
Hi, Emily Lakdawalla here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. Dr. Lewis Friedman is one of the co-founders of the Planetary Society and our Emeritus Executive Director. That was a job he had for about 3 decades before handing it over to Bill Nye. He had a long career at the Jet Propulsion Lab before that, where his work included heading the lab's Mars program. Now he has written a book about some of his most fascinating and very entertaining experiences in the early years of the Society. Planetary Adventures from Moscow to Mars is available from Page Publishing and elsewhere. We've got a link on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. The mention of Moscow in the title is key, as you'll hear if you listen to any of Lou's great stories from the book. He shares many in the online version of this week's show that's also available at planetary.org/radio, including one about his Mars balloon adventure that ended in Soviet Lithuania with a case of mistaken identity. Here's a different one that goes back to 1987. How did you end up helping to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Sputnik 1 launch?
Well, the principal organizer on the of all of this, and a man who anticipated perestroika and the changes ending the Soviet Union before they happened, was Raul Sagdiev, who also, by the way, became years and years later in the late 90s, a member of the board of the Planetary Society. Sagdiev was always thinking ahead, and we had developed a very strong working relationship at the Planetary Society with a senator from Hawaii by the name of Spark Matsunaga, who was an advocate of something called the International Space Year. This was going to be in 1992, 1993, and I was promoting both a pan-Pacific cooperation, but also broad international cooperation. And he organized an International Space Year Conference in Hawaii. Sagan went, and I think Bruce Murray went, I went. Several Russian participants, included Sagdiev, and of course many American scientists were there, all talking about the possibilities for exploring Mars together. While we were there, Sagdiev comes over to me and says, Lou, take a walk with me out into the ocean. I want to do a little swimming, and could you accompany me? And I said, sure. And so we walked out together, and then when we were away from earshot from anybody, he says, I've done you a lot of favors over the years. I want you to do one for me. He said, I just got approval for a 30th anniversary celebration in Moscow. We have an unlimited budget, basically, to pay the travel expenses, but it's only 4 months from now, and we want to invite lots of American participation. We want to invite all the Apollo astronauts. We don't know how to do this. We've never done anything like this in international cooperation. It's a new day for open Soviet participation. I said, well, sure, we can help. And we had email in those days, so we, primitive email, I should say. It was a Western Union-style email, but it worked. We began sending emails to all of our colleagues and to the Apollo astronauts and many friends we had developed over the years, inviting them to go to Russia for this 30th anniversary celebration. And one story I tell in the book is that the Soviets chartered a flight, Aeroflot, big jumbo jets, and they told us all to meet at the airport in Washington, D.C., and they would fly to Moscow. And then when we got to Moscow, they'd tell us what hotel we were in, and they had made all arrangements and return tickets and everything like that. But one of the Apollo astronauts, actually Richard Gordon, who flew on Apollo 12, he comes up to me during the flight. He says, Friedman, if anybody had ever told me that I would be on a Soviet airliner flying a one-way trip into Russia with no idea of where I'm going or how I'm getting back, I would have punched him out. And I stood up. I said, are you going to hit me? He said, no, I'll trust you for a little while longer. And But we did, and we ended up, that celebration was a milestone. It was remarkable by the people who did attend, both American and Russian space officials. We had visits to the Soviet training site at Star City, where the astronauts trained. It was all a first-class celebration, and I think it was an important milestone in advancing space projects. Of course, what none of us knew at the time was that it was sort of the downslide of the Soviet Union. Communism was ending, and their active participation in space ambitions was also going to end.
Lou Friedman with just one of the great stories in his new book, Planetary Adventures from Moscow to Mars. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, and he is here to make some waves, some gravity waves. Black hole gravity waves. We'll get to that in a few minutes when we talk about the contest that we put in front of you a couple of weeks ago. But right now, what I want to say is welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
What's up there? I'm not even trying for the comet anymore.
Well, try for some meteors. We got the Perseid meteor shower peaking on August 11th and 12th with increased activity several days before and after. You'll get the most meteors after midnight, but it's a trade-off because that's also when a quarter moon will be up interfering with some of the meteor visibility. So just pick a good time, go up and stare at the sky and keep those clouds away. And we still have great planets to check out, whether you see a meteor or not. We've got in the evening sky, in the evening west, southwest, Jupiter, super bright, Saturn to its left, looking yellowish. And then the pre-dawn, we've got Venus, super bright over in the east. If you look to its right, you'll see Orion. And in the middle of the night, we've got Mars coming up in the east. And the moon will be joining Mars, very close to Mars, on the 9th, and Venus on the 15th. On to this week in space history. 1990, the Magellan spacecraft went into orbit about Venus and started its radar mapping that would give us all sorts of new insights into Venus. Did you know it was a Planetary Society contest that led to the name Magellan?
You know what? I did not know that. I mean, it's before my time, with the society anyway. Nothing else is before my time.
And then something you do remember, hopefully, 2012, I can't believe it. You can't believe it was 8 years ago, Curiosity landed on Mars.
You're right. I don't believe that.
We had a big event. It couldn't have possibly been that long ago.
I was jumping up and down. Yeah, I was in the back, making sure your microphone stayed on.
Thank you, by the way. I've meant to thank you about that for the last 8 years. Speaking of microphones, this microphone will hear me say, Random Space Fact.
And I'm still keeping your mic on.
I know, I appreciate that. Talking about splashdowns, the first to successfully splash down after spaceflight, monkeys Abel and Baker in 1959 aboard Jupiter AM-18.
And they were monkeys. This is before the chimps, right? Like Ham started going in the Mercury capsule.
I went deep into
a black hole.
Relativity and black holes. Good old Carl Schwarzschild solved the Einstein field equations for the geometry of empty space-time around a non-rotating, uncharged, axially symmetric black hole with a quasi-spherical event horizon. I asked you who first solved those equations for these same conditions except for a rotating black hole, and note, same conditions would have implied uncharged. With all of that insanity, how did we do, Matt?
I'm just so shocked to say that the number of entrants was somewhat depressed this time.
like fewer entries, or just thinking about this stuff made people depressed?
I think most of them were depressed, which black holes tend to do that to me as well. But yes, the numbers as well. Not a bit surprising. So kudos to those of you who made it through. You know, there were actually, I think it's safe to say, more than I might have expected for a question like this. I'll get to our winner in a moment, but we have two poems. One from Gene Lewin up in the state of Washington. We'll open with that. A Kiwi mathematician back in 63 exacted a solution for relativity, proving black holes rotate before nary a one was found. Nonlinear equations proved his calculations sound, describing the geometry of this empty space-time, expounding on the formula of the eminent Einstein. Professor Emeritus Roy Kerr of Canterbury U, also quite adept at bridge, of metrics, he bids too. I'm not a bridge player, but I kind of get it.
That was impressive, and I had read that he was quite the competitive bridge player.
We're talking about this guy from New Zealand, right? Roy Kerr.
Roy Kerr of the Kerr metric, the Kerr geometry, the Kerr bridge player.
One more poem from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild. Gravity waves are what LIGO detects, and in 2016, they declared, we noted a merger of black holes at last, and both of them must have been Kerrs. But what is a Kerr? I can hear you exclaim. They're named for the man who uncovered the solving of how a rotating black hole's geometry must be discovered.
Wow.
That was a great
one. These poems were impressive.
I never did mention the winner.
You know, you should probably do that. We have a long-standing tradition of having a winner.
Congratulations to Curtis Franks in the state of Ohio. Curtis, first-time winner as far as I can tell. You, Curtis, are going to get your choice. Either the Planetary Society 40th anniversary t-shirt that shows all those different objects around our solar neighborhood where they were at the time the society was created, or the equally cool vintage Planetary Society t-shirt with our original Clipper ship logo brought back by a Chop Shop store on our behalf. That's where the Planetary Society store is. You can also get there from planetary.org/store. A whole bunch of other cool stuff, too. So congrats again, Curtis.
How about a different question that does not involve general relativity? What was the only unintended splashdown of a spacecraft carrying humans? And I don't just mean it landed a few kilometers away from where they intended. I mean unintended splashdown of a spacecraft carrying humans. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Wow, good one. All right, you have until the 12th. To answer this good one, that would be Wednesday, August 12th at 8 a.m. Pacific time. And we'll keep it up. We'll go with the same prize choice once again, either the 40th anniversary t-shirt or the t-shirt featuring our original Clipper ship logo, which was co-created by Carl Sagan, one of our three founders. And that's it. I think we're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and ponder whether miniature golf courses use miniature black holes at the last hole to take your ball away from you. Thank you, and good night.
Did I ever tell you about my idea? I tried to, you know, sell to one of those companies that advertises late-night television. It's the Singularity Toilet. It needs no sewage connection, and you don't want to use a plunger. That'd be very dangerous, but...
God. Yeah, it's genius, genius.
He's Bruce Betts. Obviously, takes one to know one, and he is our chief scientist at the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. The Singularity Toilet, patent pending. Did I mention that the energy it generates also gets you off the grid? Actually, gets your entire continent off the grid. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its proud members, some of whom have been with us from the start. It's never too late to join them at planetary.org/membership. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.